Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Near the conclusion of the final book in the Harry Potter series, author J.K. Rowling, through the character of Dumbledore, states that words are our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it. If that's true, why do we use our words so poorly? I make my living with words. I write a lot, I speak a lot, I listen to and attempt to synthesize words constantly. So my ears may be particularly sensitive, maybe too sensitive, but I do notice when I misuse a word or a phrase. I notice when others do. I try to be forgiving, especially in a conversational setting, as I know none of us always use words and phrases and grammar precisely as we intend or as the rules of grammar we learned in school require. But there are some phrases, some malapropisms, some cliches, some ill-conceived sentence structures up with which I shall not put. Maybe you are the same way, and if so, today's program is most definitely for you. We're going to talk about words and word usage, grammar, pet peeves, and the like. And our guest is Dennis Barron. He's a longtime professor of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois, and he has joined us on air a number of times through the years to discuss a wide range of subjects linguistic in nature. Dennis Barron, welcome back to Focus.
Ah, great to be here, Craig.
Glad to have you with us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
As we begin our conversation, we welcome you to it. In particular, we welcome any examples you'd like to share of words, phrases, or grammar pet peeves you may have. We also welcome questions about the origins of words and phrases popular in everyday life, or anything else you'd like to know about why we use the words we use the way we use them. To join our conversation on air, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or go the social media route. You can find us on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online or on Twitter at Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Yesterday, Dennis, we solicited some examples from our Facebook friends in the Twitterverse of poor grammar or word usage that really gets on people's nerves.
Okay. The doctor is in.
I thought that's the way we could start out with some of those examples and talk a little bit about them. So let me start with Mark, who shared, "There is no such word as a lot, as in A-L-O-T. You can make a lot of mistakes, as in A space L-O-T, but not a lot of mistakes, as A-L-O-T. That seemed to really bother him.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Do you think that is something that could someday become its own word as opposed to two separate words?
Yes.
And that can happen a lot,
it's pretty
right?
common. You know, you've got all right, moving over from, you know, two words, all plus right, to one word,
And losing an L in the process.
Losing an L in the process, although, you know, occasionally somebody puts it back in. This could happen to a lot. And the thing is this. It doesn't happen in speech, right? It only happens in writing.
It's just a question of how we represent it on the page.
How we represent the spoken language on the page or in visual symbols. And the conventions for this change, yeah, you know, we tend to think of spelling as written in stone. It's not even written in silicon. There's spelling changes over time, and there's spelling variation going on synchronously. So we're used to the British versus American harbor with an O-R or an O-U-R, color O-R, O-U-R. Theater in America is R-E or E-R, depending, you know, maybe on how pretentious you want to be or something like that. But right. For whatever reason, you see the variant there. So, you know, I write a lot as two words, and I see people do it, and it's typically considered a spelling error or a writing error, but there's no... if enough people do it, it won't be an error. It'll be the new way to do things.
Let's move on.
And besides, if you are talking about the Twitterverse,
right. I just made up a word there.
It saves a space.
That's right.
Anything that saves a space, because, you know, we're used to thinking now in 140 character thought chunks. We're going to go with the one word a lot.
And that gets to your word of the year. This is a little tease for later. Later in the hour, your word of the year has something to do with what you were just saying. Let's move on to another example.
So wait, I've got a comment on. Okay, I'm not done here.
I'll just sit here, take a drink.
Well, you started out with this quote from J.K. Rowling, equating words and magic, and then you start going on about, we use words so poorly so many times. People do. How many good magicians do you know? Words are magic, but how many people are really good at the other kind of spelling?
Well, I was hoping that was rhetorical. I don't want to offend any magicians out there.
you've got Hermione correcting in the first book, correcting how people pronounce their spells.
That's
if
right.
you don't say the spell right, it's not going to work.
All right, let's go on to the next example. This is Leslie, who has a particular frustration with the different ways people make use of the word your, or specifically that they use Y-O-U-R when they mean Y-O-U apostrophe R-E or vice versa.
Yeah, it happens all the time. What do you want me to do?
Fix it. Fix it.
I can't fix it. You could look it up. But again, this is something that doesn't happen in speech. It's only when we transcribe.
She also
speech.
Raises a
so,
couple.
So it's one thing to when a feature is found in the spoken language and then carries over into the written language, but we're really dealing with a difference between oral and a symbolic communication writing, there are things that sound alike, and so why should we be surprised when we confuse them in the written form? There are plenty of easy ways to fix that. If you're interested in fixing it, you just look it up, it tends to be something that spell checks don't catch. So as we become more reliant on spell checkers, we may find these errors popping up more because we don't self-edit as much as wait for the machine to edit our writing.
Let me then raise some examples that aren't strictly the question of a difference between spoken and written.
Okay.
This also comes from Leslie. She points out a couple of malapropisms, guesstimate and supposedly.
Guesstimate's not a malapropism.
It's
an invented word that's supposed to be cute. If you don't like it, you can call it a malapropism. I don't use it because estimate seems to do the job just fine. But a guesstimate is a less certain estimate, I suppose.
Okay. And how about supposedly versus
supposedly? Supposedly is, that is usually characterized as an error. It's a common enough thing. It's like grievous instead of grievous. And people will say, okay, supposedly or grievous, they're not words. They're not real words. And people use them far too often. Well, if they're not words, how come people are using them?
That gets at the heart of all of this, doesn't it?
That gets to the heart of it. We judge other people's language. We judge our own language. We self-edit. We react to how people speak and write, and we make decisions based on that. And that's probably a normal part of the way we communicate. So it's not surprising that we do this, but we shouldn't be surprised to see variation in language because that's built into the system. Some of the variations we're not going to like.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking about words, word usage, grammar, pet peeves, and all other matters linguistic in nature with Dennis Barron. He's professor of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. And we welcome examples that you would like to share of words or phrases or grammar pet peeves. We also welcome questions about the origins of words or phrases popular in everyday life or anything else you'd like to know about why we use the words we use the way we use them. To join us, you can call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will begin this morning with Rick in Robinson, Illinois. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. I am so often offended by professional broadcasters, which I hear almost constantly on WILL. People who should know that pronunciations incorrect pronunciations are so common, but they do nothing, it seems to me, to do anything about it. The case in point is a broadcast narrated by Audie Cornish yesterday about the elements of light from the Bell Laboratory, spoken by somebody named Andrew something, where he spoke throughout about a musical performance or record, using the word carillons. And I wondered what on earth he was talking about, carillons. And finally, because it seemed to be about bells, I realized that he was talking about carillons.
Is it carillons? Is it carillons? How is it pronounced?
Who knows? I've always said carillons, but I've certainly heard people say carillons.
It's an interesting example to raise.
Yeah.
I thank the caller for that example. And that does raise an issue that we all deal with within broadcasting. When you have a source describing something, is it more authentic to let them describe it the way they describe it, or do you correct them some way? You know,
it seems to me if the interviewer corrects the person that they're interviewing, that's not going to create much rapport in the interview.
You can't do that.
So this is not actually an example of a professional broadcaster mispronouncing something. It's an example of somebody being interviewed by a professional broadcaster saying something that the listener doesn't like. In the old days, you are probably too young to remember this, Craig.
Okay.
But in the old days of radio, all the networks had pronunciation guides. And in order to qualify to be an announcer, to go on the air, you had to memorize these guides and pass speech tests.
It is interesting you mention that, and maybe this is an indication of me showing my age, but one of the first jobs I ever had on the air before I could go on the air, I had to take a test. Now, it happened to be for a classical music station, and they were, of course, testing my
pronunciation of composer's name.
Exactly. But,
this was a general. The idea was to create a kind of network standard of speech that where everyone was using the same pronunciation. There was no regional variation. There was no ethnic variation. The idea was to create this kind of uniform spoken voice on the radio. They did this in England, too. And American broadcasting loosened up on this quite a bit earlier than the Brits did in terms of allowing people with New England or Southern accents anything else, any kinds of variations from the sort of received pronunciation or standard American pronunciation on our side of the pond.
Now, we do still have, I mean, for example, NPR within the public radio sphere, I have discussions all the time about how do we pronounce this or that word and try and standardize as much as we can.
Sure. And the common words in the news, they come with, you know, sort of pronunciation guides. If you have, you know, or spelling guides as well.
No one ever figured out how to spell Muammar Gaddafi's last name.
No kidding. And, well, you know, because you're transliterating it from another writing system.
Which is why I got into serious trouble with my third grade English teacher over the spelling of Hanukkah. But that's a long story
day. Yeah.
You know where
Hanukkah's
I stand on
over.
That. Let's go next to Stephen in Urbana. Stephen, good morning. Stephen, are you with us?
Stephen, wake up.
All right, that was the last chance for Stephen. We're going on to Shirley in Charleston. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I have a question about the past tense of flee, as in taking a plea or pleading to something.
Mm-hmm.
The past tense is they'll say pleaded rather than pled.
Right. That you
and
get
for
the
other
ver-
words.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Read goes to read. Plead goes to bled. But plea goes to plead. completed, and I just was curious about that.
It's just a variation. We don't say readed. You're absolutely correct about that. But we do vary between pleaded and pled. I think, I don't know, does pled strike people's ears now as sort of old-fashioned?
I don't know that either one is old-fashioned or not. I think that does raise a question.
Yeah.
Sometimes people, I think, are more upset by words that strike their ears wrong,
mm-hmm.
whether they are or not, versus words that, if it sounds like it could be okay, they're okay with it.
Sure, yeah? Sure. And the ED past tense has become the normal way in modern English to any new verbs that we create typically have an ED past tense. So this has become the dominant pattern in modern English. In older forms of English, there was much more variation between what we call the strong and the weak verbs. So plead, pled, sing, sang, sung, think, thank, thunk. No, that's not a good example. But you get the drift here.
Yeah. Let's go next to Honora in Urbana. Good morning.
So we've had speed dating. This is speed grammar.
That's right.
Speed grammar.
Speed
we
grammar.
Just go right through all these callers. 1-1-1. We'll get you taken care of. It's like Jiffy Lube for language.
All right, Honora, go ahead.
Sorry about that.
I actually don't have a grammar question.
Okay.
I'm watching a baby grow, and I find it fascinating to watch her learn how to distinguish things like this versus that,
mm-hmm.
and how she's figured out how to call herself me. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about language acquisition and how our words and usage sort of emerge from that fog of Babel.
Okay.
Some of us never emerge from the fog of Babel, but thank you for the question.
it's fascinating to watch kids acquire language because they acquire one form of something, and they often generalize that form to everything. So I'll give you another, you know, a cute example that I use in class. When my nephew was really, really little, we were up in Chicago at the zoo with him, and he was just learning to talk too. I forget, he's about 18 months old, something like that. And he generalized a couple of things. When he was learning, you know, kids learn what does the cow say, what does the dog say, that sort of thing, and so he generalized animal sounds as moo, and for some reason they didn't have pets, and any kind of animal that he saw he called a birdie, and so we're at the zoo and we're coming up to the elephant enclosure, mm-hmm. and he sees the elephants and he's jumping up and down, practically throwing himself out of his stroller, and he's shrieking at the top of his little voice. He's saying, "Birdie, birdie, moo, moo," pointing at the elephant.
Yeah, well,
kids do that, and that's a stage. It's a stage in language acquisition where you equate some kind of sound symbol with some kind of meaning, and as you go a little further into language, you start sorting it out, and you know, he obviously today he's a college student, and
so it worked out all right.
He knows the animals and he knows the different sounds they make, and you know, multivariable calculus and all that stuff. It's easy
but it
for
is,
him.
I imagine it is for new parents, especially, really fascinating to watch that development of languages as a child just sort of first starts to separate animals and sounds and words and letters, and that's why I imagine concentration games and flashcards are so effective, and you know, toys that give that repetition so you learn to differentiate these different things.
Yeah, except for the fact that when parents try to correct their children language-wise, it tends not to take.
Yeah.
So there's that too. I mean, they love picture books and they love looking at things and pointing out objects and what's that, what's that, what's that, what's that. And you know, I mean, when my son was growing up, he sort of generalized that. It was, you know, whatever it was, and we could never get him to specify what that he was referring to was for the longest time. And then we have a friend who had a son, and he was in the back of our car once about the same age when my son was doing that long, long ago. And we're driving down Lakeshore Drive, and he says, "What's that?" And we said, "Well, what?" He said, "That over there, that." And, you know, we're driving for about 10 minutes. He's pointing. He's very excited. He really wants to know what it is, but we could never figure out what. Is it the building? Is it the ship? Is it what? You know, no, no, not that. Not that, Dad.
And did you ever figure it out?
Nope. Mysteries of language continued.
Mm. All right, next we go to Greg. Good morning, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's very interesting. I just, there's a word that I've become, that to me is bothersome. It's becoming bothersome, and that's the use of the word transparent and what it's intended to portray as far as clarity and perhaps truthfulness or anything like that. And it just seems to me that it's not a very representative of what might be factual or truthful, or maybe translucent would be a better word.
So you find transparent opaque?
Yes, thank you. I'm traveling, so I'm going to listen.
All right. Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, there's a difference between transparent and translucent. Translucent means light goes through it, but transparent means you can actually see what's on the other side. You can see through it rather than just have a sort of vague sense that something's lit up.
So you
there.
Could hold up a stone to a light, and some stones' light will shine through, but you can't really see
through a glass
clearly.
Darkly. Think about that. You know, it's where transparent is actual clear vision. Through an object.
Ultimately, maybe that is the best way.
Yeah, so it does really mean visible. I'm not sure what caller doesn't like, but, you know, let him go with translucent.
All right, we'll go next to...
Cloud the issue.
Jackie in Champaign. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My pet peeve has started occurring over the last couple of years listening to NPR and a lot of other radio stations. And
you should only listen to NPR. Forget about the other radio. They will never get it right.
Well, it's okay. Anyway.
I can say that Craig can't trash the competition.
Dennis Barron's views do not necessarily reflect the views of WILL or its subsidiary. Go ahead.
Oh, sure they do.
Anyway, the word for, F-O-R,
F-O-R,
is being pronounced fur, F-U-R, and it just turns my hair backwards.
Okay.
And I want to begin by apologizing, because that is one of those words that I have struggled with my entire career.
It's a regional accent kind of thing. Nothing more than that. I mean,
I worked at a radio station that used to have a slogan, "Your station for quality music and news." And I could not.
Fur.
I struggled so hard to keep from saying "your station for quality music and news."
Yeah.
It's tough.
Well, you can't announce classical music and say fur, I guess.
Right.
They don't go together. You've got to have the snooty accent.
I would differ with that. I think snooty is a mistake. But
snooty is a mistake. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. And I'm sorry on behalf of everyone everywhere where you've heard that.
We're sorry for that.
You're not the only one. It's a lot of people.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And next up is Ron in Decatur. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a bone to pick with National Public Radio.
Everybody's ragging on the radio today. What's going on here?
Consistently, and I mean consistently, they'll be announcing some corporate supporter.
Huh.
And they'll say, this support was given by XYZ Corporation, who? This win is a corporation a who? It's a which.
No. Federal law defines persons as corporations. And the Supreme Court has ruled in Citizens United that corporations are entitled to free speech protection for political speech. They are not entitled to the right of personal privacy, however.
In common usage and language, shouldn't that be a who and not a which? Or shouldn't it be a which and not a who?
Sure. I don't think of corporations as people, except when I'm angry with them. But, they're technically entities. But, you know, it's... NPR is dancing around the fact that they're...
We ought to be technical here and try and do it right.
Well, NPR is dancing around the fact that these are actually ads, and they're sort of pretending that they're not. And so this is part of that whole language thing.
Once again, the views of Dennis Barron do not necessarily reflect the views of et cetera, et cetera.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So technically I'm correct.
I would say so, would you not?
So-and-so corporation, witch. Yeah, I would probably call a corporation a witch. I don't like to anthropomorphize
Now, I think we need to move away from who in order to, change our election laws, and that would be a step in the right direction to start calling them witches.
You know, you just...
All right, well, that's a whole other, sound-alike word there.
But Ron, you just reminded me of an example of something that we're constantly attempting to be vigilant about in the newsroom, which is making sure that we correctly make use of the words its and their.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when we will refer to an entity in the first draft of a story type their, T-H-E-I-R, yep, where we mean I-T-S.
Right, right, because... Corporations are actually mass entities, and so in American English we treat these things as singulars, but in British English they treat them as plurals. So the government are, the government say, in British English we would say the government is.
Mm.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. And we welcome your phone calls this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu as we continue to take your calls about words, word usage, grammar, pet peeves, all other matters, linguistic in nature. We're talking.
You don't have to call to complain. You can call to celebrate language the way J.K. Rowling seemed to want to do it, that language is magic, not that language is always a bad thing.
Well, that may be partially my fault for instructing and suggesting,
you're soliciting
stirring things
complaints.
Up a bit.
You're soliciting complaints. You never need to solicit them. They come no matter what.
All right. So if there's something you love,
something
a particular
you love
word
about language,
you
is
wish
there something
to use more?
That NPR announcers do right?
Oh.
Let us hear about it.
All right.
And, send a check.
That's Dennis Barron. He is professor of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. And we will take more of your phone calls as well as some emails as our program continues. First, though, a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Dustin Hoffman. He makes his directorial debut with the new film Quartet. When he received his Kennedy Center honor, he was praised for breaking the mold of the movie star as handsome leading man. But when Hoffman starred in The Graduate, people said to director Mike Nichols,
"What a great film you would have had if you had not miscast the lead."
Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers professional cleaning and repair service for Oriental and other handmade rugs and provides repair and restoration services for fringe and sides, holes, rips, and animal stains.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing words, word usage, grammar, pet peeves, and all wonderful things that you hear, all the beautiful language that you hear from public radio and all other matters, linguistic in nature. We're talking with Dennis Barron, professor of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. To join our conversation on air right now, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We will carry on next with Mike in Champaign. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm calling about a phrase that has invaded our popular culture, and I'm looking for some ammunition to win my family arguments that this phrase is used in a totally inappropriate way most of the time. The phrase is "no problem."
You would prefer that people say "no prob."
Exactly.
Exactly. Well,
not quite.
Oh, okay.
It's a thank you that is needed most of the time when you get a "no problem." This is from someone at the counter at McDonald's, or a waitress at a restaurant, or a bagger or checker at a store. Their job is to serve you. If you're not asking them to go above and beyond, or even if you are, no problem just isn't appropriate, I don't think.
So well, people say thank you, and instead
say,
of you're welcome,
they say
no
problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why that is, but it is very, very popular.
It doesn't rub you the wrong way, apparently, as it does.
Apparently, it doesn't. No, okay. Except for the fact that when things get used a lot, and thank you and you're welcome get used a lot, they tend to lose their meaning. They tend to lose their semantic content, and they become simply functions. So they are politeness moves in conversations, and there's not a real sense of thanks or a real sense of welcoming. When we really feel something heartfelt, we have to express it somewhat differently. So what happens is that these things become simply tags in language, and when they lose that semantic content, they are easily replaced by other things because we get tired of them and we look for something else, a new formula to replace them. That's also meaningless. No problem doesn't mean this is not a problem for me. It's simply a politeness tag, and for some reason, your welcome has gone out of favor, and no problem has replaced it in the sort of commercial exchange that you're referring to.
The other thought that I've had when it comes to your welcome is if it is a tag, mm-hmm. and it is insincere, mm-hmm. that can come off as almost insulting.
Right.
Almost like, oh, I've gone over and beyond to serve you in some mm-hmm. way. You're welcome. And, of course, mm-hmm. it's the way with which you say it.
What does your welcome actually mean? It doesn't mean what we're using it to mean. You know, your welcome means, you know, come on in. But that's not how we're using it. We're simply looking for a tag to reply to thanks.
Hmm. Well, I guess in a service environment or that sort of thing, part of my point is I don't think you can give those people a problem. They're there to serve you.
They definitely can give you a problem, and you can give them a problem. These service exchanges are not always smooth ones.
Well, that's true.
Sometimes it's the customer that's at fault, and sometimes it's the company.
So the customer isn't always right.
The customer is not always right, and you know the business model is moving towards the customer is always wrong. But
don't get me started on that,
because I'm a customer.
That's part of my point.
If I were a business, I'd probably take their side. But its side, whose side? Singular, plural, if I were a business.
We may actually be closing in on the day where it's to receive a you're welcome, press 1. To receive
no problem, press 2.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
Thanks
for the call. Next up is Phil in Champaign. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning. So earlier you were talking about the broadcasting kind of phrases that everybody picked.
Mm-hmm.
One that it seems like meteorologists have all focused on, which just drives me nuts. I don't know why it drives me nuts, but it does. I mean, I don't speak perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. I'm actually one of the supposedly people. So
okay.
But someone pointed that out to me the other day. But they say miles an hour instead of miles per hour. Now, I did take like science classes and stuff. And,
okay, so the wind, so like me, wind velocity or something like that.
Yeah, you know, it would be like, you know, winds coming in at 27 miles an hour, but they don't go like miles an hour and say it quick, you know, like you'd kind of expect if someone was just saying it, they're like mm-hmm. miles an hour, like they go out of their way to enunciate it.
Right.
If you're going to do that, why not do it right and say miles per hour? I mean, if you're just going to say it, it doesn't bother me, but it bothers me because they're so clear about it that it seems like they've all decided we're going to say miles an hour. And, you know, like when I was, you know, back when you do math and stuff, you know, that per was kind of stressed in class that it had to be per because mm-hmm. you're talking mm-hmm. about this relative to something else.
I guess
I thought that was weird.
Yeah.
What you got to say about it? So.
Well, I guess, A, I haven't noticed the switch, and B, it sounds kind of natural to me when you say miles an hour. So I must have subconsciously noticed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? The only thing I can say is that, again, we're dealing with a case where per is not, you know, is a borrowed word. It's a Latin word, and it's often used in technical contexts, right? So maybe it's just a kind of folksy alternative to sounding technical,
and
yeah,
and
I don't know, and you know, I'm just guessing at what the motivation might be, and I don't think people are doing this consciously either. I think they're just sort of slipping into this miles an hour, miles per hour. Maybe
it's miles. It's the number of miles in an hour, miles per hour. Mm-hmm. So it's the mm-hmm. same thing mm-hmm. essentially. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So, like, when you guys...
I mean, why don't they just say it's windy?
Down, you know, and... Well, anyway, I guess I had another one that I didn't actually tell the guy who takes our calls about.
Okay.
it's not a big deal, but I've just kind of noticed it. My daughter's actually, you know, like kindergarten, and they're, you know, kind of working on words and stuff. And
yeah.
So I've been noticing what she does. And she uses the word what for the word that.
Oh.
I don't know. It doesn't bother. It's just kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but she'll be like, you know, that, hey, you know, that is the car.
What I want, what I like.
What's at the store, you know, like that kind of thing.
What is it? I don't know. She probably work her way out of that at some point.
Even if she doesn't, that's fine. I thought it's funny. All right. Well, thanks very much. I'm enjoying the program. So.
Okay, good.
Have a good one.
You too.
Thanks for the call.
No problem. Sorry, I couldn't help that.
That's all right. I want to share a few emails.
It actually was a problem, but I'm not going
to
say it.
I'm going to rattle off a few emails here and then just give you a chance to comment on any of them.
Okay.
One of them, my own pet peeve, this individual says, is the number of younger people today who use the adjective good instead of the adverb well.
Sure. Young people are notorious for using bad language. Old people are notorious for using good language. How they make, where at the point at which they stop being young and start being old, suddenly their language improves? I mean, I don't get it. Next.
All right, next. three words that bother me, or words or... incorrect words or questionable words. Stupidest, littlest, snuck.
Okay.
So
be very bothered.
Yes. Well, that's fine. I will admit I share the word stupidest is one that bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because it was not within the lexicon until really the last 20 or 30 years, it suddenly
I don't know.
I
remember, you know, kids, I think, reinvent stupidest every generation. You know, more stupid, most stupid is probably the correct. But, you know, if you're going to call somebody stupid or something stupid, do it in whatever way is most effective.
We have an email from Peter. He says the uses of the objective cases and pronouns seem to be changing. For example, I now hear even educated persons using I as the object of
Between you and I.
Yeah, you and I.
That's been going on for years and years and years. We don't know really why people do this. They used to think that it's because people had me beaten out of them in elementary school, but I don't think that actually ever happened. It's become an idiom in English, the between you and I. People who say that will never misuse the objective case in any other kinds of collocations, and so it's really achieved idiom status. And idioms are notoriously grammar proof. They don't observe the normal constrictions that grammar imposes on language, because they become formulas that we just plug in.
We have a tweet from Alva who says, irregardless, today's focus about incorrect grammar usage is literally the best that I've ever heard, hashtag irony.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear snark.
And that actually leads us into
the word of the year.
The word of the year for 2012.
The word
2012.
Of the year.
What
da,
was
da,
it?
Da, da. Wait, don't you have a fanfare button?
No.
That's
the
wrong
budget
kind of
cuts.
Right, a little horn that you beep, beep, beep.
I can give you a little drum roll.
Okay, there you go. The word of the year for 2012 in my blog, The Word of Language, is hashtag spelled with the hash symbol in front of it. It is the word that has come to be used on Twitter to group topic-related posts or tweets into something that can be easily searched online. It has spread beyond Twitter. It's used outside of Twitter, and it is starting to be used in the spoken language as well. We have quite a few attestations, examples of people saying, oh, I went and saw hashtag this or hashtag that in their conversations. And there was even a report of a baby named hashtag in 2012.
Oh, no.
The American Dialect Society announced its word of the year in January. I announced mine back in December. And at a meeting in Boston, which I attended, a nomination from the floor, and it wasn't from me, for hashtag, and groundswell approval. It overwhelmingly won word of the year for the American Dialect Society. Beat out marriage equality, which is the one I was voting for, but I didn't actually vote because I felt I was, since I had already named a word of the year, I shouldn't mm-hmm. vote on this. And YOLO, You Only Live Once, the acronym for You Only Live Once. and a number of other candidates for Word of the Year, so they declared hashtag Word of the Year.
And you were saying this was the first time in 20 years?
First time in 20 years that my choice was the same as the American Dialect Society.
So have they caught up with you, or
you
caught up with
them? Oh, yeah. No. Okay. They have finally seen the light.
Well, and then let's take another hashtag call from hashtag Ruth and hashtag Champagne. Ruth,
okay.
Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to commend Craig for saying a couple of examples, because there's a very strong tendency.
A couple examples.
To leave bothers me.
Yeah. Get those little one-syllable words are easily lost.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, and I'm glad
did
that right.
Our request for praise has elicited some response. So we don't do everything badly, wrongly. Wrong, incorrect.
We should have
stupid.
You here in studio every day to remind me to ask people to call in with compliments.
Compliments.
It's much more fun. Yeah. Let's go next to Jerry in Paris, Illinois. Jerry.
Hi.
What's your comment or question or pet peeve or what have you?
Well, I don't really know why it bothers me, but when you go to the grocery store and you check out, they always say, "Did you find everything okay?" when they really mean, "Did you find what you were looking for?" Normally I answer, I haven't checked everything in the store, but what I looked at seemed okay.
And what's the point of it? I know a lot of businesses have started forcing their checkers to say these things, because these are scripted. These are not things that people think up on their own. This is something the corporation tells their employees to do to improve customer relations.
In restaurants, often a waiter or waitress will just, in passing, say, "Are you okay?"
Yeah.
And I keep thinking to myself, what, does it look like I'm having heart palpitations?
Right, Do you need a Heimlich maneuver here? over here, right. Scripted employee behavior is fairly common in these kinds of workplace situations. But my response is always, well, what if I didn't? I mean, I often don't find what I'm looking for. But at the point that you're checking out, you are not in the mood to go back if somebody tells you, it's in aisle 13B, to find it, because you lose your place in line and blah, blah, blah. So what's the point of asking it even? They're expecting a yes.
We have a comment also from David on Facebook. He says, when a waiter or waitress asks, this is something that he really hates, when they ask, "Are you still working on that?"
Yes.
He says, "I always want to reply after screaming, of course, 'Do you have that low an opinion of your food?' Either that or
it takes work.
Or, yep, now if you'll excuse me, back to the salt mines."
Yeah. Again, don't blame the servers.
I'm not, you know.
They're probably, in most cases, told to do this, and if there's a secret shopper or a secret diner from corporate headquarters and the employee doesn't say what's in the script, they get demerits.
There's another example from a commenter on Facebook saying, my waitstaff pet peeve is when they say, "Are we ready to order? Do we want dessert?" He says, "I didn't know they were eating with me."
Yeah. The whole, I don't know why people can't let employees just use natural language to communicate with clients. They are so afraid that it's going to be bad for business, when in fact clients tend to be put off by anything they perceive as formulaic language.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Jerry.
You're welcome.
We'll go next to Marlene in Urbana. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I'm similar to your last caller, Jerry. The word that peeves me is something that I hear I started hearing, and now I'm hearing it everywhere, but it started that I heard it with Wolf Blitzer on CNN.
Ah, well, Wolf Blitzer.
And it really aggravates me when he's introducing.
Let's hear some critiques about Fox News.
And he says, "And here is so-and-so, and she's working on the story."
Yeah.
Well, I think it should be instead of working on, he says she's working the story.
It's just a little bit of journalism jargon.
Sculpting her the story the way she wants to, like working a sculpting, and instead of working on. So how many other situations with prepositional phrases and such are like that?
I don't know, but it sounds like a bit of journalistic jargon is all it is.
And everybody is doing
the story.
It now. She's working the story.
Mm-hmm,
I'm thinking, well, am I really getting the true story?
Well, and I wonder how much of that has to do with this concept that in some circles in journalism, they believe it's important to give the impression that you are always, use whatever phrase you want, on top of things, always developing a story that may not have any developments yet.
Right, and there is, you know, there is a sense, too, in broadcast journalism of differentiating between people who are actually investigating and people who are simply reading a script.
Right.
So the difference between the true reporter and the news reader.
But that still would be working on the story.
Right. And some of this.
Yeah. I understand that. But
What I'm getting at is that there is this sort of notion of action news that some pervade.
Yes, it's more hands-on to work a story
but
than
it's
to
not,
work on the story.
It's not necessarily actually working on the story. It's using language to represent the idea that you are working on the story.
Yeah. It's all smoke and mirrors.
I'll leave it up
it's
to you to
magic.
Determine whether you think that's what's happening there.
It's magic, you know.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We'll go next to Gary in Urbana. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Yeah, I'd like to get your reaction to a sentence like this. Gasoline is very expensive anymore.
Ah, okay. Mm. Anymore without the negative constraint tends to be a regional idiom, and you find it in this area of the Midwest, central Midwest. Stretches eastward into Indiana and possibly Ohio, westward into Missouri. People who don't use it, who have to use something like nowadays instead, find this gasoline is so expensive anymore as completely odd, unacceptable, unidiomatic. People who do use it think it's perfectly natural. It's uh-huh. simply a regional distinction.
Go ahead.
Has that been around a long time?
Yes, it has.
I feel like 30 years, and I only started noticing it maybe 15 years. I don't know. But
yeah, you got to get out more, I think, because it has been around for probably 50, 60 years at least.
I came across a similar regional affectation. I lived out east for a number of years.
It's not an affectation. It's a variant.
A variant, okay.
Affectation implies intentionality.
Okay. Well, understood.
Let's do this right, Craig. You're on National Public Radio, and your critics are out there waiting to pounce.
I thought we were complimenting.
Oh, right. Your critics are out there ready to compliment
you
for using variation instead of affectation.
The example I was going to cite is, I first came across this, I was stunned, and it was in a restaurant, and waitress walked over and said, "Would you like a Diet Coke a while?"
Ah, okay.
I had never heard that before.
Now, that one I haven't heard either.
And it's basically, you know, while you wait for a while. And I sat there and thinking to myself, well, I guess I would like it as long as I'll be drinking it.
For a while, yeah. And you know, maybe the taste lingers.
So some of this stuff is most definitely regional.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, Gary, thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks.
And let's try and get in at least one more call. We have Mary on the line from Urbana. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two concerns. One is how often now you hear people refer to or say me and my daughter instead of my daughter and I or me and Bob. I mean, I hear intelligent people even saying that, and I don't know if they think that the rule doesn't apply anymore that we were taught in school. I hear that a lot. And another thing is I guess if it's a dangling preposition, if you walked into my grandmother's house and said, "Where is Susan at?" You would say, "Down in the cellar behind the at." But you hear those all the time.
Where is it at? Yeah. I mean, there's a joke about this that cannot be told on public radio.
Oh, come on.
No.
Clean it up.
No, I can't do it because it's no longer a joke. If you clean it up, but it's normal to end sentences with prepositions in English. There's no grammatical reason not to do that. There are occasionally stylistic reasons that started being talked about in the 18th century to avoid it. Simply when you're writing a long or saying something that's long or writing a long sentence. That leaving a ending with a one-syllable word that's far away from the rest of what it's connected to grammatically can possibly confuse a reader or a listener. So the idea was to group words together that are syntactically related. But there's no idiomatic reason, no real grammatical reason to fault something like where's it at. If you don't like it, you don't like it. And if you use it, you use
right.
it. And it's just one of these variants that happens. It is what Craig started out with, presumed a statement by Winston Churchill, insolence up
right.
with which I will not put, when he was supposedly chided by a young journalist for ending a sentence with a preposition, and Churchill said,
about when people are fixed and to do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an idiom too. That it's just an informal. So it's very common. Goes back hundreds and hundreds of years to be fixed and to do something. And the new variant is finna. Yeah, I finna do it. You know, meaning I'm getting ready to do it. I'm preparing to do it. And it's informal. And so people who object to these sorts of things are saying, well, we need to be more formal in our informal communication. But in communication is generally moving from a more formal to a less formal style in many situations.
Can I ask one quick question? If somebody calls on the phone and I answer it and they ask, is this Mary? And I say,
It's me. Is that the question?
This is she.
This is she. Yeah.
What is the correct way to answer that?
Just say yes.
And we'll have to leave it there.
We're running out of time. Otherwise, I'm going to be reading the news.
Dennis Barron is professor of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's great to be here. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Grammar.
That would be hashtag.
Hashtag. No,
no it's
at,
not hashtag. It's sign.
At sign.
Dr. Grammar. Hashtag is something else. All right. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.